Just a few days before the end of July, the Irish Republican Army announced that it would abandon its armed struggle and turn to politics to achieve its goal of unifying Northern Ireland with the Irish Republic. A joint statement that was issued by the leaders of Britain and the Irish Republic and could be said to be cautiously optimistic. Mr. Blair, Mr. Hearn said, if the IRA's words are borne out by actions, it will be a momentous and historic development. The president of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, said the announcement pointed to, quote, a new and peaceful mode in Northern Ireland. He said there was a time to fight. There was also a time to engage, to reach out and put the war behind us. However, on the unionist side, and this is the side of those people who favor continued union of the North with Britain, there were clear doubts voiced about the sincerity of the IRA and its declaration. And here, for example, is one quote that comes from Ian Paisley Jr., son of the leader of the Democratic Unionist Party. He said it would be an act of unparalleled stupidity to accept the words of the provisional IRA and the words alone. We want to see peace, but we're not going to be taken for a ride, like some people. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a journalist who has spent a lot of time following Irish politics. His name is Ed Maloney. He has been the Northern editor of the Irish Times and the Sunday Tribune. He's also written for The Washington Post, The Economist, and The Guardian. In 1999, he was elected Irish Journalist of the Year. He now makes his home in New York. He's the author of a book that came out a couple of years ago, and we talked about here on this program, a book titled A Secret History of the IRA, and published in hardcover when it was new by W.W. Norton. I'm sure the book is still available if you'd like to read it. Questions on this program are welcome, too. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many as possible and keep the program moving. But anyone interested in joining the conversation, making a comment, asking a question is certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. In fact, if you would happen to be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Maloney, hello.
Hi, hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
No problem. My pleasure.
I want to talk about a number of things here, and certainly why it is that this happened and why now. But perhaps first, I should ask the question, just how significant is this?
Well, that remains to be seen. And I think those people who have been reacting to the IRA statement with caution and saying that that we will wait and see what actually happens and what the IRA does, or more particularly what the IRA doesn't do in terms of violent or illegal activity, I think they are the ones who have caught the mood best, I think. There is a considerable amount of caution surrounding this statement, a lot of optimism, but considerable caution. And that's quite simply because, you know, we're talking now in August 2005. This peace process officially started in August 1994. That's 11 years ago when the IRA called a ceasefire to facilitate this process of getting involved in politics. And that's 11 years. This must be one of the longest peace processes in the history of human conflict. It's longer than the American involvement in Vietnam. It's twice as long as the European involvement in the First World War. It's nearly twice as long as European involvement in the Second World War. And this is a peace process. And the reason why it's lasted so long is that it's been full of problems and difficulties and lack of trust and breaches of agreements and so on and so forth. So, you know, people are somewhat skeptical and cynical at the moment. And you know, welcome though the statement may be, I think most people are waiting to see what actually happens.
Hmm. Well, certainly a major sticking point, low these many years, has been the resistance of the IRA to disarming, what's sometimes called decommissioning. Has that been the major sticking point? Certainly it can't have been the only one.
Well, no, it's not the only one, but it has been a major one. And the IRA has decommissioned weapons in accordance with a scheme that was agreed between the various governments that's involved in the Irish peace process. And the American government, incidentally, is very strongly involved in this process, more on the sidelines and cheering things on and helping things and making constructive suggestions. But it's an involvement that's taken very seriously. And there was a decommissioning scheme set up. The problem with it is that it's entirely secret. We know nothing about it. We don't know how many weapons have been destroyed. We don't know if weapons have been destroyed, really. We've just got the word of the man who's in charge of the commission, the Canadian general, and I'm sure he's telling the truth, but we just don't know how these weapons have been got rid of, whether they're, you know, dipped in a bath of concrete, whether they're chopped up into small pieces or blown up or thrown over the side of a trawler in the middle of the North Sea. We just don't know. And therefore, there's a considerable amount of distrust about the process. You know, people are asking the question, well, if the guns are being destroyed, why make it so secret? You know, why not be open about this and create trust? And that has been a problem. But I rather think, you know, it's been overtaken by events, really. You know, this IRA statement that we had a couple of weeks back was provoked by a series of quite extraordinary incidents at the turn of the year. First of all, you had this extraordinary bank raid carried out by the IRA, in which over $50 million worth of was taken from the bank in the center of Belfast, and that was followed very quickly by a very brutal and savage murder, a stabbing to death of a young Catholic guy by an IRA gang who were drunk and out of control. But that caused problems because there was a huge cover-up afterwards about the actual stabbing. And both of those incidents illustrated that the IRA didn't need to have, you know, tons of explosives. They didn't need to have, hundreds of heavy machine guns or millions of rounds of ammunition in order to create instability. The problem was really the IRA itself. It was the continued existence of the IRA itself. And it sort of highlighted, you know, something which was, I suppose, in the background all the time, but has now become quite prominent, which is that if the IRA has ended its war against the British, what's the reason for it continuing to exist? I mean, you know, most armies at the end of a conflict demobilize, yet there is no sign that this is about to happen or will happen in the near future. That's going to be a continuing problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I think you point there to a key point, because as you say, the IRA said that it would get rid of its weapons. It didn't say that it would disband. And,
no.
So then that would lead to a question. What does anybody think the future of the IRA would be if it continues to exist? Would it become a more political organization? And then I suppose some people would say, well, there's Sinn Féin. What does IRA need to become a political party for?
Yeah, I mean, it really comes down to basic fundamentals here. You know, why continue to exist? Why have an army when you have peace? Mm-hmm. And the problem, of course, as well, is that the IRA has its own rules and regulations, indeed has its own constitution. And while publicly the IRA has issued this statement recently saying that its campaign against Britain is over, and incidentally it didn't say its armed struggle was over. It didn't say it was abandoning the use of armed struggle. It said it was just ending this campaign, and that its members would in future commit themselves to peaceful and democratic methods. That's a public statement. The private situation is that the constitution that rules the IRA has, you know, certain commitments there which have not been changed at all, one of which is a commitment to use, when possible, armed struggle and violence in order to get rid of the British. And that's a problem which is there, and it stands there in conflict with the public statement that they will only use peaceful means and that the war is over. So, you know, that's again a difficulty. Why does the IRA want to do that? What is it going to do with itself? There are suggestions that a large section of the IRA will be absorbed into the new policing system. That will cause an enormous amount of controversy. But there's also a great difficulty involved in continuing criminal activity on the part of the IRA, and that's going to be there for some time, you know.
Mm. Let me reintroduce very quickly the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Ed Maloney. He's an independent journalist who has been writing about Ireland for a long time. He's the former northern editor of the Irish Times and the Sunday Tribune. He's written for the Washington Post, The Economist, The Guardian. He is author of a book that was published not too long ago titled A Secret History of the IRA. And we're talking about recent events in Northern Ireland, and questions are certainly welcome from people listening. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As you say, the IRA has had some rather bad press lately, both the big bank robbery in December and then the murder of Robert McCartney just in January. So when one asks the question, why now, how, to what extent was the desire within the IRA, perhaps also within Sinn Féin, to generate some positive publicity behind the timing of this announcement?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's been a masterstroke in terms of marketing. They've really pulled off quite a coup here, despite the fact that they robbed this bank of $50 million and there's no sign of the money being returned at all. There's been no sanction applied to them. Tony Blair has instead both welcomed this statement, and of course the problem with the statement is that it's really just an admission of what was already a reality. The IRA's war against the British had ended years ago. And he's accepted that statement, said that he believes it, and also given a long list of concessions to the IRA's political wing, which has upset a lot of unionists in Northern Ireland. So for a very, very low cost, the IRA has got back into the game, and Gerry Adams has got back into the game with a vengeance, and have come out of this well ahead. So they're bound to be very pleased with themselves at the moment.
Mm. One of the things that in many of the stories that I have read about this that comes up is the pointing to the terrorist attacks here in the United States of 9/11, September 11, 2001, is playing a role, and that in even though that was a few years back, that contributing to this feeling within the Republican movement that they don't want anybody to be able to lump them together with a group like Al-Qaeda.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about it. 9/11 changed everything, because it made the use of violence for political ends, what is commonly described as terrorism, something which was from then on was going to be associated with the mass murder that took place in downtown New York on that day. And the IRA has many, many Irish-American supporters, has lots of political friends in this country, and there was just no way that they could risk going back to a war and being tarred with the same brush as Al-Qaeda and have any chance or any hope that they would keep those friends and keep that political influence.
What's anybody's best guess at how many members the IRA has?
Well, in terms of that's quite easy to work out, because the IRA from time to time holds delegate conventions, and they normally send on the basis of one delegate for every 10 members, and the conventions usually consist of about 60 people. So we're talking about an active membership, which is the tip of the iceberg, if you like, of about 600. But underneath that, of course, there's be huge numbers of people supporting in logistical ways and propaganda and all sorts of other ways. But in terms of active, cutting-edge members, you're talking about 600.
Mm-hmm. And how many of those people would have ever been involved, directly involved in some kind of violence?
Oh, most of them, at one stage or another. Mm-hmm.
To what extent now is part of the problem, and I think you touched on this, that on both sides, on the Republican side and on the Unionist side, there are people who have gone far beyond any action that could remotely be interpreted as being politically motivated, and what we've got increasingly is simply criminal gangs carrying out criminal activity.
Yes, that is a major problem, and it's one which I think is going to become a crisis for the peace process and for politics in Ireland, because the level of involvement and the amount of money that's involved in the crime and racketeering that's going on is quite staggering. It takes several forms. Because there's a border there, it's very easy to take advantage of differentials in currency and in tax rates to smuggle smuggle things like fuel, diesel. Cigarettes are stolen and sold door-to-door. There's a protection racket. There's armed robberies. And a lot of this money is now is being laundered. The thinking is probably in offshore companies and then coming back as legitimate investments, and that the IRA and its supporters are becoming extremely wealthy and extremely rich, to the point where some people fear that it actually could have a destabilizing impact in the long term. And this is a problem that's going to be there. The IRA is still in existence. It has not been disbanded. What are its members going to do? And, of course, the assumption of a lot of people is that they will drift, as they have been increasingly drifting, into racketeering and criminal activity for personal gain and for organizational profit at a faster and faster rate. And it's sort of symbolized, if you like, by the guy who's their military commander, the chief of staff of the IRA. He lives on a farm which straddles the Irish border. One part of the farm is in the south of Ireland, the other part is in the north of Ireland. And he runs a fuel and diesel smuggling enterprise from his farm. The guy is known by the authorities on both sides of the border to be deeply implicated and involved in this type of activity. It is said that he is a euro millionaire several times over, so rich that, in fact, in the past he's been able to subsidize IRA operations out of his own pocket. And nothing, literally nothing, has been done to stop this guy's activities. And the reasoning is that if this guy is undermined, if he's put out of business, then that will cause unrest and cause problems for the political leadership of people like Gerry Adams, who needs the support and loyalty of people like that. So the fear in Ireland is that criminality, one of the reasons that criminality is growing, is not just because you have an out-of-work army with the skills that are very useful for criminal activity, but that also because the two governments are essentially, the British and the Irish governments, are essentially turning a blind eye to a lot of it. And the difficulty there is that this problem gets so big that it becomes uncontrollable.
Well, let's talk with the caller. We have someone here in Champaign County where we are on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering about you apparently spend a fair amount of time in your book about the Machiavellian rise of Gerry Adams. And I heard you on another show saying that one of the things that you illustrated it with was the hunger strike time. And that they had made some kind of agreement that covered 80% of the grievances, but that Adams was pivotal in keeping it going. It seems to me that there may be other points, but to actually be able to convince people to starve themselves to death, it seems like they have to share that rather passionately, the idea of going all fasting to the death. It doesn't seem that you can actually say that Gerry Adams, how do you say that Gerry Adams was pivotal?
First of all, I didn't say that, although I do raise questions in my book about the fact that the hunger strike lasted so long, and that it, you know, I sort of discussed the idea or the suspicion in my book that one of the reasons why the hunger strike lasted so long is that it was politically advantageous to the Sinn Féin leadership because it allowed them to stand once again in the seat at Westminster, which had been won by Bobby Sands and then, when he died, had been made vacant. But in relation to the specifics that you're talking about there, that's not me that said that. Very interestingly, that's a book that came out this summer, and it was written not by a journalist, but by a guy who was the number two person in the IRA command structure inside the jail during the hunger strike, who was therefore privy to all the negotiations that were going on between the prisoners, the IRA leadership, and the British government. And his assertion is that at a certain point, after I think about the fourth death, the British government made a secret offer, which was transmitted via the Republican leadership outside the jail into the prisoners, whereby they would get 80% of their demands. They had, I think, five demands, which ranged from refusing to wear a prison uniform through to getting their lost remission back and stuff like that. And they were going to get four of those five demands granted to them. And the leadership inside the jail of the IRA prisoners, the people who were leading, as it were, the IRA protest, not the hunger strikers themselves, but their sort of military leadership, if you like, said that's a great deal and we want to accept it. And they sent a message out to the Republican leadership, to the IRA leadership, and they got a message back from Gerry Adams saying it's not good enough. And therefore the deal collapsed. And the result was another six people died on that hunger strike. But in the course of that protest being extended, Sinn Féin was able to stand another candidate in Bobby Sands' seat. And because of the emotion of the hunger strike, was able to win it. And on the basis of winning that seat, Adams, the following year, was able to go to his organization and say, we need to get involved in electoral politics as well as armed struggle. And it's from there that most people date the beginning of the peace process. So it's a very seminal moment. But you're wrong. I didn't say this stuff. One of their own people has said this.
Well, maybe you were citing it, and I missed the reference. But
no, because the book...
You were the gentleman that was on Democracy Now! With Juan Gonzalez.
Oh, sorry, yes. You're talking about a media interview. Yeah, I thought you were talking about my
book. Not in the book, no.
Okay, yeah.
But I think on the program, you actually said that, and maybe you were, maybe I missed it, maybe you were saying people say, or it's been said, that Gerry Adams was Machiavellian and used this
to
cement Sinn Féin over the objections of people. Well, you know, it seems to me that maybe you can say they're weakened by their hunger strike and are susceptible or something, but for someone to fast to the death, it doesn't seem like you can persuade somebody from the outside.
Well, it wasn't a case of persuading them from the outside. It was a case of saying that this deal was not good enough to justify the deaths of the four colleagues that had already gone. And the way that the hunger strike worked was that people went on hunger strike either one at a time or at the very start two at a time. And by the third or fourth death, those who were about to embark on the hunger strike had hanging over them, right, these sacrifices made by comrades, prison comrades before them, that they had died. And the pressure on them to keep going, no one needed to put pressure on these hunger strikers to say you should keep this hunger strike going, because the pressure was coming from the way that the hunger strike had been constructed. The pressure was coming from the deaths that had already occurred. Now, that's a separate issue in a sense, although it was part of the mechanism that kept the hunger strike going. But what really kept the hunger strike going at that point, when the secret deal was made, was that the message came back from Gerry Adams on behalf of the leadership of the IRA, saying four people have died, this deal's not good enough, we want all five demands. And in the face of that, you know, what do these prisoners do? Do they defy their own leadership and say, screw you, we're ending this hunger strike, to be then covered by, you know, opprobrium, you know, throughout Republican Ireland as a result of abandoning a hunger strike for a deal that the leadership said was not good enough, and after four of their comrades had died agonizing deaths? That's how the pressure happened.
Am I on?
Yes.
Let's put that aside. And what other instance are you citing about Adams and his Machiavellian?
Well, the examples...
You're saying. How about just one more, then?
Okay, the examples are legion, right? but just the very peace process itself. I mean, what I say in my book is that this peace process can be traced back to, first of all, the hunger strike and the fact that the Sinn Féin leadership and the IRA leadership endorsed an electoral strategy in combination with an armed struggle. And that happened in about 1981, 1982. And I date the start of the peace process to that period when Gerry Adams began a series of discussions with Catholic clerics in Ireland, discussions which eventually embraced the Vatican as well, and eventually led to, first of all, informal contacts with the British government, the Irish government, and the leadership of the SDLP, and then ultimately to the peace process and to the ceasefires and to the deals that we have going now. Now, my argument is essentially that at no stage of that journey. Could Gerry Adams have gone to his colleagues on the Army Council of the IRA and said to them, listen, guys, I have a proposal here. We're going to accept the principle of consent. We're going to accept the legitimacy of a Northern Ireland Parliament. We're going to take seats in that Northern Ireland Parliament, and also we're going to become ministers in a power-sharing government. And Martin here is going to be Minister of Education, and Barbara is going to be Minister of Health. And you guys are going to get rid of your guns, and eventually you're going to have to go away. He wouldn't have survived the experience. He would have been, you know, found, as they say, in a ditch somewhere. There was just no way that this peace process, this peace strategy, which Adams and the small group of people around him had devised in the 1980s, would have been acceptable at that stage to the remainder of the IRA leadership, or indeed the rank and file. And my argument is that the way Adams did this, the way that Adams achieved acceptance for the peace process at the end was by dint of maneuvering and manipulation. And one of the ways in which this happened was to manipulate the armed struggle in such a way that it brought discredit to the IRA and demoralization within its ranks. And I give the example, the best example that I give in the book is at a time when Sinn Féin is standing for elections and the IRA is bombing and shooting, and IRA operations are killing civilians, and as a result of killing civilians, they're losing electoral support. And Gerry Adams is standing up on Sinn Féin platforms, warning the IRA to be careful about its operations and not to endanger civilians. At the same time that that is happening, he, on the Army Council, agreed with and endorsed a proposal put forward by the Northern Command, led by Martin McGuinness, his closest political associate in this peace strategy, to employ a tactic which predated 9/11 in the use of human bombs. That they endorsed a tactic whereby individuals who had some sort of tenuous link to the security forces, where their families were kidnapped, they were put into vans loaded with explosives and tied into the seats and told to drive to army checkpoints. And then their bombs that were behind them in their vans would be detonated by remote and radio control, resulting not just in the deaths of the soldiers at the checkpoints, but also the bomb couriers, the hapless individuals who had been intimidated into this tactic. Now, if you can see what the logic is of, on the one hand, warning against the use of the deployment of operations which endanger civilian lives, and then on the other hand, endorsing a tactic which, in the annals of public relations disasters, is probably unequaled. I can't answer that. All I know is that the effect of the use of the human bomb tactic was to demoralize the IRA internally and to bring huge amounts of credit, discredit and criticism on their heads. And in as much as that contributed to an atmosphere in which people said this armed struggle is getting nowhere, we have to get into politics, I cite that as evidence of the way that Adams manipulated this process because he couldn't win the argument otherwise.
I'm going to jump in here. I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're past our midpoint, and I want to introduce again our guest. We're talking with Ed Maloney. He's an independent journalist who's been following the politics of Northern Ireland for a long time. He's been the Northern editor of the Irish Times and the Sunday Tribune. He's written for the Washington Post, The Economist, and The Guardian. In 1999, he was elected Irish Journalist of the Year. He's author of the book A Secret History of the IRA. It was first published in the fall of 2002 and is now available in a paperback edition of both the hardcover in the paper published by W.W. Norton. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. 1-800-848-9455. One of the things that you report in the book, contrary to the steadfast denials all of these years by Jerry Adams, you report that he is, in fact, high up in the leadership of the IRA. I did want to ask you about just one reference in one of the many stories that I read, reporting that both Jerry Adams and Martin McGuinness had said that they were going to step down from the positions that they held in the Governing Council of the IRA. Of course, they never said that they were in the IRA, either of them. Do you have any knowledge to that effect?
Yeah, it wasn't they who said that. It was a minister in the Irish government who said, Minister of Justice, who's in charge of policing and security, who issued a statement or gave an interview in which he said that his understanding was that part of this deal, part of this process that the IRA had launched with his statement would include Jerry Adams and Martin McGuinness stepping down from the Army Council. And, of course, when asked by the media to comment on this, both Adams and McGuinness said, well, how could we step down from something we were never members of? Mm-hmm. So they're still in sort of insisting that they never really had any linkage to the leadership of the IRA. And you know, I think that's really by this stage, you know, greeted almost with laughter in Ireland, because it's, you know, it's one of the assumptions of the peace process is that there is absolutely no way that Jerry Adams and Martin McGuinness could have steered the IRA into this direction, which has involved considerable political compromise, without them actually having been not only members of the IRA, but heavyweight members of the IRA who carried a great deal of respect inside the organization. So, you know, yes, he's been in the IRA since he was 16. He's been on the Army Council of the IRA more or less full-time since the mid-1970s. He's been a former chief of staff of the IRA. He's been a former Northern Commander of the IRA, and so has Martin McGuinness. Hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the political success of Sinn Féin? How is it doing as a political party?
Well, they're doing extraordinarily well. The peace process, you know, has brought them huge electoral dividends. On the grounds that peace is popular with Catholics in Northern Ireland, and they've been rewarded with votes. I think partly on the basis that the more votes they get, the more difficult it is for them to go back to war. So more Catholics have switched over to voting for them in Northern Ireland. But they're also doing well in the South, and I guess more or less for the same reasons that, you know, Adams is regarded as a statesman, a man of peace who's brought this war to an end, and it's very much a party that's whose success pivots around his popularity, and he is you know, a very media friendly sort of guy, and very very skilled and experienced with the media. He comes across very well, and you know, they have reaped all the dividends, and they are now. What they now have representatives in the Irish Parliament, the British Parliament, the Parliament in Belfast, which was set up as a result of the 1998 agreement, and also the European Parliament. Now, you know, 10, 15 years, 20 years ago, that would have been unthinkable. So they're now a major force in Irish politics. They're the largest Catholic or nationalist party in Northern Ireland. They will probably end up with sufficient members of the Irish Parliament to be a junior partner in a coalition government, and Ireland, you know, has had a recent history of nothing but coalition governments, you know. So they are doing very well indeed.
Let's talk with another caller here, someone in Charleston. This is line 4. Hello.
Yes, I seem to detect some bias here against Jerry Adams. And I think my only suggestion is just now, if your guest could give us an accurate historical perspective of why these things have happened and why they continue to go on, and all this animosity between Protestants and Catholics. And I'll just take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Maloney, do you have a bias against Jerry Adams?
No. I regard him, you know, as an extremely important figure who is worthy of, you know, the most stringent media coverage. And, you know, if I'm guilty of anything, it is putting him under a spotlight, which is often, you know, has been a very uncomfortable spotlight for him. But you know, he's a public leader. He's been at the top of this this organization for the last 30 years or so. Consequently, you know, he should expect people to delve into his history. And I delved into his history, but I've also, you know, your speaker, you know, may not be, or your listener there may not be aware of the fact that I've also written other books. I've written a biography of the Reverend Ian Paisley, which was equally probing and equally unflattering, and unflattering because there are unflattering things to find in Ian Paisley's history and life and background, just as there are unflattering things to be found in Gerry Adams' history and life, you know?
Well, for people who have been listening to us or have read stories over the years about this conflict and who come away just scratching their heads feeling they don't really quite understand what it's about, or concerned that it often is just reduced to a religious conflict, when in fact it's probably not as much about a religion as it's about a lot of other things. Can you, in a very brief kind of description, say essentially what really is this all about?
Yeah, it's not about religion. Religion, is, you know, is the gives the labels to the divisions, just as black and white give the labels to divisions in a country like this. It's the detritus left from Britain's history of imperialism. Ireland was Britain's or England's very first colony. And the British and the English very quickly perfected the technique of ruling by dividing people, and that's what they did in Ireland. And they also had other interests in Ireland, one of which was to prevent invasion of England from the back door through Ireland by Catholic countries like Spain and France. And what they did was literally to transplant hundreds of thousands of loyal Protestant people from the south of Scotland and from the north of England, and give them land in the north of Ireland. And, of course, that land was taken away from the native Catholics. And they were there as a buffer, as it were, to at least delay an invading army from France or Spain. And, you know, you can't do, you can't conduct sort of huge experiments like that, huge social and political experiments like that, without massive political costs. And, of course, one of the costs from that is huge division. And really, I suppose, at the end of the day, it's a land question. It's about, you know, it's about land that was taken by others, and the grievances are still there. So essentially, that's the situation as I would describe it in Northern Ireland, and the legacy is there, and it's going to be there for a long time.
One of the things we talked about at the beginning was that this statement now by the IRA that it would be giving up its arms, and the big question being, how exactly would that happen? How would the process be overseen? Has anyone really talked about what kind of mechanism might be used to try to deal with what is reported to be tons of weapons that are hidden in bunkers across Ireland?
No, that is the problem. And we've had, I think, three or four tranches of decommissioning already in the last since September 2001. It was, in fact, the 9/11 attacks that you know, provoked or led to IRA decommissioning beginning. But the arrangement between the IRA and the decommissioning body that conducts the process is one in which there is a secrecy agreement, and we're not allowed, the world is not allowed to find out how these weapons are destroyed, how many weapons are destroyed, and so on and so forth. And it's a matter of considerable secrecy, and that's going to be the same from now on. There's one small difference that they have agreed that the next decommissioning process, which is supposed to be the final one when the rest of the IRA's arsenal is finally got rid of, on this occasion the process will be apparently witnessed by a Catholic priest and a Protestant minister. But we don't know whether the Catholic priest and Protestant minister will be able to stand in front of a press conference and say, yeah, we were on the trawler and it was all thrown over the side into the North Sea, or whether they are going to be bound by the same secrecy, which will limit them to saying, we saw weapons decommissioned, but we cannot tell you anything more than that, in which case it's as unsatisfactory as it was before.
Given that there is such a reservoir of bad feelings between people on the two sides, between Republicans and Unionists and their leaders, their political leaders, Even if this is a positive step and that it will lead to other positive steps, one really wonders just how possible it is for these two groups to sit down in a political sense and in a real physical sense and work together.
Yes, I mean it's you know at the very start of this interview I pointed out that this peace process is 11 years old now and there's no sign of it ending, and so you know it must be one of the longest, if not the longest, peace processes in the history of humanity. And you know the fundamental problem is that there's a lack of trust, and there's a lack of trust on both sides. A lack of trust on the part of Republicans that the unionists don't really want to share power with them, and then there's a lack of trust on the part of the unionists who disbelieve the IRA's commitments to peace. And because there have been so many concrete examples which support people's suspicions, such as, you know, the robbery in the Northern Bank, or such as, killings and other incidents that have taken place, that fuels the trust and makes it much more difficult for people to get together and sit down. And there is also, of course, a suspicion that the creation of instability is something which is to the benefit, in this case, particularly to the benefit of Sinn Féin, and that they really, at the end of the day, don't have much interest they have more interest in the process than in ending the process. The process brings them political and electoral dividends. But ending the process with an agreement which means that it's all over, that that we're sitting together in government, that there's no armed groups left and there's no killing and what have you, that is not necessarily something which people think the Sinn Féin party really wants to see.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, let me introduce our guest. We're talking with journalist Ed Maloney, who's been covering Ireland for a long time. He's author of a book that was first published a couple of years back titled A Secret History of the IRA. It is now available in paperback. It's published by W.W. Norton, and questions are welcome. Yes. You're still there? Mr. Maloney?
Yes, I'm here. Oh,
okay, good. I thought maybe for a moment we might have had a problem. Something else that I'm interested in having you talk about in response, seemingly in response to the IRA announcement, and perhaps this was something that had been in the works, that the British government announced that it would move toward demilitarizing the North, meaning that they would pull out troops, they would defortify police stations, they would be taking down some big guard towers, and also as part of this move, there is a move toward constructing a police organization there for the North that would be more like just a normal urban police force, and also to make this a balanced force, balanced between Catholics and Protestants. This whole process has been extremely controversial and difficult. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yes, well, demilitarization is you know the logic of the situation that we're in. There is no armed campaign by the IRA against the British. Their troops and policemen are not being shot at. They're not being subject to bomb attacks and so on and so forth. So there is an inevitability about dismantling all the security apparatus that was initially constructed to counter a terrorist campaign or conflict. And of course, it hasn't happened, or it's happened only just recently, because the British have been using that as a bargaining counter with Sinn Féin and the IRA in their negotiations, that if you do this, we'll do that. And one reason why it's only happening now. But yes, we have security problems nonetheless remaining, and one of them is the construction of a policing system, which commands sufficient support and consensus to function properly. And the old policing system was by and large dismantled and replaced with a new one, in which there were commitments to recruiting more Catholics than there would be Protestants, to try and get a police force that ended up with a membership that reflected the demographics in Northern Ireland more accurately than in the past. This has not yet been achieved. And there are huge difficulties in the way. And, there are suspicions that, again, the unionists and the British don't want things to change. And there are suspicions that the Republicans want to infiltrate and take over the police system and in some ways subvert it. So all these things are there. It's going to take a long time for these things to be sorted out. But I think fundamentally, though, you know, even though one has, and I have my doubts and suspicions about people's bona fides and all of this, and that's simply because of my experience of reporting on them. You know, as a reporter, when you're told, you know, a lie once or twice, then you know, it colors you. When you're told lies for the third, fourth, fifth, or sixth time, then you begin to disbelieve everything. And that's the stage that I was at when I left journalism in Northern Ireland. And that's there. That's going to be a huge problem. It's a lack of trust. But the point remains underneath all of that. Even though there is all these difficulties ahead, the war is over. The violence is over. The killing on the scale that we used to know way back in the 80s and 1970s. That's a thing of the past. I don't think it's possible to return to that. I think the mood has changed so fundamentally in Ireland against violence of this sort that it just wouldn't have any support at all, and it would self-destruct. So, you know, the war is over. Of that, there's absolutely no doubt.
I have a couple of callers. We'll try to get them in the time that remains. Someone else here in Champaign County. It's line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I have a brief question. I've been reading in the papers recently about the three IRA, I don't know what to call them, experts on bomb making have escaped from Colombia. They were indicted and out on bail and supposedly sentenced, and they've shown up in Ireland. I'm not sure exactly where. No one's sure exactly how they got in. I wonder if your guest could speak to this. You might have mentioned it before, but I tuned in late. So, thank you.
Yeah, well, we didn't. Yeah, I thank you for the question, yeah. Mr. Maloney.
Yeah, sure. This episode goes by the name the Columbia 3 episode. This was a case of three people, two of whom had very senior IRA histories, particularly in the IRA's bomb-making and engineering departments, who were arrested in Colombia in, I think it was August 2001, just prior to September 11th attacks here in New York. And they were arrested and they were put on trial. Initially, they were acquitted on charges of aiding terrorism, and the charges specifically was that they had gone to Colombia to exchange their technology in homemade or improvised mortar devices for cash with an organization called FARC, which is a left-wing anti-government guerrilla organization operating in, I think it's the western Colombian jungles. And they were initially cleared, and then there was an appeal, and they were convicted. But in the meantime, of course, they'd been let out, having been acquitted, and they went into hiding. And then just last week, just, you know, literally a few days after this IRA statement, they appear in an interview on Irish television. Now, where they are now, no one really seems to know. Everyone's looking for them, but it's caused enormous embarrassment. And it's again, one of these episodes that, I was talking earlier about events that happen that undermine the trust and the faith in the bona fides of the IRA's intentions vis-a-vis the non-use of violence. And this is a perfect example of that, and it's just one of very many. And we're now in a situation where the Irish government is facing considerable international embarrassment because it's committed to the war against terrorism along with the Americans and so on and so forth. And here they have these three guys who've cocked a snook at everyone, and there is no extradition treaty between Ireland and Colombia. So what on earth the Irish government is going to do about this, no one really knows. But the embarrassment is all rebounding very strongly to Sinn Féin's advantage and to Gerry Adams' advantage. And again, as an example of people saying, looking at this stuff and saying, are these people really genuine, or they just want to create instability through another way? You know, that's the difficulty here.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank the caller. I want to try to get one more. This is Champaign in line 1. Hello.
Yes, sir. I just came in on the conversation, but prior to doing that, I was reading the New York Times editorial page and letters to the editor page this morning, and there's a letter to the editor by Rita O'Hare, Sinn Féin representative to the United States, Dublin, August 9, 2005, and to the editor, Ray, the RRA's Gift of Gab op-ed, August 5, your name, Ed Maloney's effort to dismiss the Irish Republican Army's declaration that it would end violent activities and dump its arms is the latest in his campaign against the peace process in Ireland, and Gary Adams in particular. And then I'm going to jump down to a more pertinent part because of time considerations. The current campaign will also fail because the communities that IRA men and women come from know that it is not true. Ed Maloney portrays himself as an expert on the IRA. To hear him echo Ian Paisley's Democratic Unionists, who demand that Sinn Féin take responsibility for ending, quote, all criminality, end quote, is bizarre. Can you comment on that?
Well, Rita is you know, Sinn Féin's publicity spokesperson, and that's what she's hired to do, to respond in that sort of way to articles that that Sinn Féin leadership or Sinn Féin party finds, you know, they don't like or embarrass them and so on and so forth. But I mean, you know, if you want me to rebut each and every point, I will certainly do so, but that would take some time. But suffice it to say, you know, the existence of IRA criminality is now something that is no longer, it used to be years ago, a propaganda point. And, you know, one would have to be very careful about taking these things seriously. But now the evidence on the ground, which didn't exist then, is so overwhelming. I mean, last time I visited Belfast was in March this year, and I was being deluged with stories from people who live in the areas where the IRA operates about this racket and that racket, and, you know, this one behaving in this way. And I even went into, I was driving in a car, a diesel car, and the driver said, "I'm going to get some cheap gas here." I said, "Well, how can you do that?" He says, "Well, there's an IRA petrol station that you go to, and you get agricultural diesel for half the price of the diesel that you'd pay for in the garage. It's smuggled across the border by the IRA's chief of staff." And we drove into that garage. It looked from the outside like a car wash place, except when you went through the curtains, lo and behold, there's a row of pumps there. And some guy comes out, fills your car up, and you buy the gas at half the price that you'd pay in the petrol station or the gas station. That gas station is like 400, 500 yards from Gerry Adams' house. Right? Everyone knows this sort of stuff is going on. It's no longer, you know, British propaganda. It's actual people on the ground who live in these areas are complaining about it.
I'm going to have to jump in. We could talk further, but we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Ed Maloney, is an independent journalist, been writing about Irish politics for a long time, former Northern editor of the Irish Times and the Sunday Tribune. His book, if you'd like to read it, is A Secret History of the IRA. It's now in paper, published by W.W. Norton. Mr. Maloney, thank you.
No problem. Thank you. Bye-bye now.